Session number 12268, Mr. Biedman, reel 4.
Biedman, reel 4.
Now, I noticed in Batavia that there was a pharma manufacturing chemist called Rathkamp. And my memory for names now isn't brilliant, but that's a name that always sticks with me. And so I said to this Japanese corporal, is it possible for me to have an interview with the commandant? And he wanted to know why. And I said, well, we haven't got medical supplies and we've got all sorts of difficult things, a lot of diphtheria. And in the tropics, you get all sorts of tropical conditions, like we suffer from a diphtheretic scrotum. And with the moist heat that's present there, and this hot area of the body, you'd actually get a diphtheretic membrane would grow. And the only way of dealing with that was of course, to get diphtheria serums. This corporal was very sympathetic, but he just did not have any supplies himself. So I said, well, if I see the commandant, I think it might be possible for me to get some supplies. So I saw, he arranged an interview with me, and he listened to me sympathetically, and I said, if I can get these supplies with no cost at all to the Japanese, have I got your permission to do so? So he said, yes. I then approached the colonels in charge of the camp and told them what I had in my mind and asked them if they would go along with this, and they said yes. So I saw Rathkamp's and told them that we needed all the supplies we could get. We had no money, but they could have chits, and that these would be honoured after the war. And I said, in any case, it doesn't seem to me it's going to be too long for the Japanese cotton on, and they'll probably intern you and take your supplies anyway. So he agreed, you know, we could have whatever we wanted. We did. And I used to get a certain amount of supplies for the Japanese because I thought it was politic to do so. Now, it's a dire offence in the Japanese army to get venereal disease. And Java, where venereal disease was absolutely rife. I don't know the exact figures, but I would suspect that 3/4 of the population had venereal disease. And they were quite attractive people. And these Japanese soldiers were far from home, etc., so it was there. So that by getting them some anti-venereal drugs, you know, I really was almost popular with them because they lost their pay and they were really treated very badly indeed if ever they got themselves infected. And I suppose in a sense they hadn't even got the drugs themselves there. So measures of supplies rolled in and we got healthier. We were also dealing with a specialised Dutch hospital or camp. These were Dutch consultants who obviously were skilled in tropical disorders, so anything that we didn't understand, we could pass through to them. And on one occasion I smuggled a microscope into them because, amazing enough, the Japanese wouldn't let them have a microscope. Very odd with things like that. Didn't want to be helpful.
Were you taking quite a risk, you know, doing that?
Yes.
I was wondering also with the radio, you know, that you smuggled in, what would have happened to you had you been discovered?
Very dire consequences. Very dire consequences.
Such as? From what you experienced?
I don't suppose they'd kill you, but they'd have imprisoned you and you'd have been beaten very badly indeed. Very badly indeed, because they hated anything going against their orders. at all. And also they use a lot of physical control in their own army. Any Japanese NCO, for example, if he discovers a man that's done something wrong, will stand to attention, take off his glasses if he has any, and then hit him violently on either side of his jaw with his fist, which knocks him over. And having done that, that's it. They've got other more violent punishments too. So the whole thing is sort of physical punishment. If they felt like it, they might have even shot you. But I think you'd have had a very unpleasant time. But, you know, I mean, these Dutch people were looking after their own people and our men. And if you could help them, you helped them. And on this, chap who headed these consultants said to me one day, "Can you get some diphtheria serum?" So I said yes. Came back and I told these two guards colonels, who incidentally were both fairly small men, they were about 5'4", I think, which all seemed odd to me. That was going to do, and they forbade me to take the serum out of the camp. They were rather worried about epidemics. My thinking was, well, I bought the stuff in, and it's our men that want it, you know, and we've got plenty, so some of it's going out. So I was in the position where if the Japanese had discovered it, I'd have been in awful trouble, and if the British had discovered it, I'd have been court-martialed too. But it got there.
I was wondering also, you know, the arrangement you had with a chemist with these drugs for the payment. Yes, did you know, was that well worked out?
Well, we simply sort of presented chits of what we wanted. And, you know, I just signed the accounts.
There seems to be a lot of faith that the, on the outcome.
Well, there obviously
of the
was.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the alternative was the Japanese at some stage were going to come and take it anyway. And that's it. Finished. And another sort of side effect of this was these people at bath camps put us in touch with some ladies' organisations who did whatever they could to help. They couldn't do much. What they did do was they provided us with lots of food and fruit for the hospital. Well, they obviously couldn't feed 2,000 men. But they did about twice a week. So they'd come up with all sorts of sandwiches, some cakes and fruit. The hospital sort of made life pleasant. And on one occasion, somebody came up to me and said to me, "Is it possible to get a piano?" So I asked them about this and they said yes. And I got permission from the commandant. And lo and behold, a baby grand piano arrived. And we had wonderful concerts. Because, as I say, with 2,000 men, you've got all sorts of talent. And this was done in the open air. And the Japanese used to come along. And that was interesting. We'd have a concert which would last 2.5 to 3 hours. And some of these young soldiers were dressed up as girls and women in the old sort of traditions, the Shakespeare traditions. The Japanese would not believe they weren't men, because they had maybe made wigs and things like this, and they'd come along and they'd lift the skirts up with their bayonets. Because they really did, they looked exactly the same. They looked like, you know, very attractive girls. You know, so, but all this sort of was an excellent way of taking away from yourself, you know. And we had all sorts of instruction and teaching. One of my orderlies had been a champion of London, chess champion, so he had regular chess classes. And I learned a great deal about chess, you know, rest of it. There were languages classes, and so we went on. And we'd have sort of odd medical lectures. So people keep themselves occupied, and the Japanese saw that they worked hard, as such there.
These people who brought the fruit and other stuff in, yes. Who would they have been? Javanese?
No, Dutch. I never. The Javanese would trade with us if we had anything to sell, any money at all. They would sell fruit or sweets or anything else to us. But the only women I saw were white Dutch.
Were they not interned then?
No, the Japanese hadn't interned them. Their quarrel seemed to be with the British Army. They did intern them. And another amazing thing was that the Japanese soldiers were very disciplined. I heard of no cases of looting or rape. In fact, they'd been punished very severely themselves if that had happened. Eventually, I think the Japanese sort of brought in Japanese girls and that sort of thing as camp followers and that. But I suppose that wasn't a particular problem out in Java. But they were very well disciplined. No doubt about that at all.
Could I ask you also about the sort of hierarchy and the organisation in the camp? For instance, the officers and the other ranks and the end. How were these sort of organised?
Now, the Japanese made very little distinction between officers of any rank and general men. The senior officers in this camp of ours were given a separate compound, which looked very crowded to me, and that was all. But they were expected to work just the same as anybody else. And in fact, I mean, that was a good thing, because I mean, at least it keeps you occupied and you're getting some physical exercise, whereas it must be absolutely soul destroying just to hang about and do not be much. I think when it came to the general staff, they treated them with a little more courtesy. Not very much, but just a little more. Certainly gave nothing extra as far as food was concerned or clothes were concerned. Yeah, I always feel that a lot of sympathy we've had since the war, the services generally, was to some part due to the fact that senior officers had all the same conditions. At least they understood it, you know. Although there's a lot of distinction in the Japanese army. As I said, they're giving the NCOs enormous power. An officer in the Japanese army had a great deal of power, even sort of power of life and death. So the thing is there.
And what sort of work was done? You know, for instance, did you go out to work apart from your hospital duties? You know, did you have any other work to do?
Well, usually if you had enough sort of work in the hospital, that sort of thing, that's what concerned me. But before it got organised, I did go out, and a lot of the work was very boring, like cutting grass in the aerodromes. And the way they cut grass is they slice a bamboo down the centre, and it's very sharp. And they just use it like a scythe. And, you know, it works very effectively. You can cut grass as short as you like with that. Then I said a lot of them were working on an enormous great car complex, etc. But really, I didn't do very much outside of the camp, Java, because this occupied me.
What would you be wearing, you know, during this period in Java?
Well, that was interesting. The Japanese ordered us to have our heads, hair close cropped, which was very sensible because it kept down infestation. And Java is just about on the tropic, on the sort of equator. It's very hot. And men found when they were in camp that it was comfortable to wear sarongs. Now, the sarong, which is very common out east, is simply cloth which is sewn on one side, so it makes a circle. And they can be in all sorts of designs. They can be sort of paisley patterns or designs of one sort or another, or Scottish or whatever. And they were very cheap indeed, so that all you did was you wore the sarong, and there were various ways of wearing them. They generally came up to about your chest, covered from chest to ankles, and then you rolled them down until they were held by your hips. And you could either fold them in the centre or get the pleats on the side, etc. Once the Japanese made the shaver heads, a lot of the men were bolshy, so they grew beards. And you had the incongruous sight of quite hefty men walking around with shaven heads, full bearded, wearing colourful sarongs, and cigars were very cheap in Java. They grew tobacco, and there was something like a farthing each. The farthing was a quarter of a penny. So almost anybody could afford to smoke cigars, so there were these men walking around with shaven heads, full bearded, smoking cigars. So there was all sorts of anomalies in the situation. Incidentally, the sarong is probably the most comfortable of all nightwear in any climate, because it's just held by the hips, and it's loose and encompasses you very well indeed. I haven't personally wore a sarong since I came at these, but I do know many men that do.
What did you wear on your feet?
As far as feet was concerned, they were sandals, because again, leather wasn't very expensive there, and you could get hold of sandals and sort of made quite cheaply. They were either leather or wood, and some men made their own sandals out of wood, and encompassing the sort of Danish colored clog. But it was very cheap indeed to wear sandals. I mean, on formal occasions we'd get into our army boots and things like this, but or if men went out working, they would wear their boots and stockings and shorts, things like that.
But would there have been also any interaction between the men in the camp and Javanese women? You know, was there any opportunity
None.
For that?
None at all. They would allow no fraternising of any description.
Did that cause problems? You know, obviously you were all very young men.
Yes, if it did cause problems, then nobody realised it. Men can adapt. This has happened, sort of, I suppose, over the whole of history. I personally didn't see any particular evidence of any homosexuality. It probably existed, but it'd be very difficult because the camp was very open, really. Again, I think that sort of sex drive ties in with food to quite an extent. So that if people aren't sort of fed well, if they're underfed, and we basically, even in Java, were slightly underfed, I think that sort of sex as such doesn't become an enormous problem.
Is there any, you know, his jumping ahead, you know, towards the end of the war, when obviously prisoners of war, you know, you did suffer much greater deprivation and your health was poorer. Did it make for any difficulties, you know, when you returned to normal life, do you think?
Oh, yes. No doubt about it. The achieving these drugs, obviously, I mean, was a great thing, because it must have saved hundreds of lives. And the odd thing was that, to the best of my knowledge, nobody ever came up to me and said thank you. They just accepted that the thing was there. As I've said, you know, on occasions, I mean, I consider that being a prisoner of war is really quite an education, and it taught me that if you could obtain goods and materials under difficult conditions, prison conditions, that once you return to the normal world, by contrast, everything would be very simple. And indeed, that proves so. It gives you a different sort of mental outlook on the whole thing. Yeah.
I think you then go off to Japan. Is that right? After Java, have you any idea what date that would have been when you went to Japan, or how near to the end of the war it would have been? Would that help?
Well, I was a prisoner for 3.5 years. And we were in Java for 9 months. So you're dealing with 2.75 years, aren't you? So 45, basically sort of 42, 43 was when we went. The Japanese didn't want me to go personally. They wanted me to stay and go back to Bandung and take charge of administration of hospital sickness there. I thought myself that if I went to Japan, I'd be in touch with Red Cross, and that news of my whereabouts would come back to my family. In actual fact, I was missing for 18 months. It wasn't a particularly wise decision on my part, because life in Java wasn't difficult and I was fully occupied, whereas life in Japan was a very different kettle of fish. The commandant of the camp sent for me and said that the Japanese corporal I'd worked with thought well of me, and that he thanked me for what I'd done for the men, etc. And then he said, you know, we'd like you to stay here. Why won't you stay? So I said, well, I'm a soldier, and I think a soldier should stay with his regiment. So he said, hi, you know, please for yes. He didn't put any more obstacles in my path. Eventually, we packed up and went through to the port and went through to Japan. Before I left, the Japanese corporal invited me to dine with him. And this was the first time he'd ever offer this. He had given me cups of tea and biscuits, and just small snacks of that sort. But he invited me to come and dine with him, which I did. And this was prefaced by a ceremonial bath. And under sort of war conditions, this meant that we had two petrol drums. One had a fire built underneath it, so the water was nearly boiling hot, and the other was filled with ice. And you had me take my clothes off and go into the bath. The Japanese always tie a little towel around their head just to keep sweat out their eyes. Go into this almost boiling water, and then after several minutes you emerge brick red, and then plunge into this ice-cold water, which is wonderful if you're young and your heart can stand it. Having done this, he then found towels and dried ourselves, because he'd taken part in the ceremony too. And then lent me a kimono and gave me quite a magnificent meal. Said how sorry it was that I was going, and gave me a little squeeze in Japanese to give to anybody in Japan. Not that I ever used it, but it was a kind thought. And then he said his sayonara to me, and about 10:30 at night, I went back to the camp. When I got to the camp, the main door was shut, so I banged on the door, and eventually one of the sentries, who was something like 15 feet above me in a little machine gun lookout, told me to go away. So I banged on the door again, and he said, you know, I've told you to go away, so go away. And I banged 3 or 4 times before he realised that I was one of the prisoners waiting to get in, which amused me. It was a strange situation. Well, I was trying to get in, he was trying to not admit me. But anyway, I did get in eventually. And I still have sort of quite pleasant thoughts of this Japanese corporal who did his best. But I found, by and large, they weren't too difficult to get on with. On one occasion, I was doing something over in the Japanese quarters when somebody ruffled the back of my head, and I looked around and there was a Japanese officer, and he was actually American by birth, but now in the Japanese army. So he said to me, how do you like your haircut? And I said, not much. And he said, why not? So I said, well, I don't think the girls and women would like it back home. So he laughed. And he said to me, are you all right here? So I said, well, yes. Yeah. Anything you need? I said, we're a bit short of sort of boots and things like that, white. And within several days, hundreds of pairs of boots arrived. That might have been a bit unusual because, I mean, he could obviously speak sort of English and could understand. But I really can't think of any great difficulties with the frontline Japanese troops.
Your experience in Java seems not to have been, you know, too traumatic.
No, it's under those conditions it was pleasant as you could have made it. You know, I mean, the men that suffered were those that had picked up tropical disorders.
Did you lose many in the camp, though? You know, how many deaths would you say there were?
Not many.
Proportion.
Not many. We had pretty good state of health, I would think. Those people who really had sort of extremely bad dysentery, or picked up one of the obscure sort of tropical disorders, tend to die, but it was I can't remember many deaths at all.